life might hand you budgets, schedules, family, and responsibility, but driving shouldn't be just another chore.
We're here to help you find a car you love. Something that fits your budget and your needs, but is fun to drive and makes you look back. I'm Todd.
I'm Paul, and this is the Everyday Driver Car Debate.
Hello, happy Tuesday. We're back with another cool guest podcast, and this is the guest podcast that makes me feel like I'm somehow legit. We have Billy okay. Johnson back on the podcast.
Yeah,
Billy,
back.
Thanks for joining us, man.
Hey, man, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me back. Good to be back.
This is cool. Well, Billy just came off his 6 hours of Spa win with Olivier Pla and Stefan Mucha, and man, we feel like we're talking to, you know, a celebrity here.
Yeah, seriously.
I don't know about that. I feel like I'm talking to two celebrities right now.
Well, you know, we've had a nice little recording already. We're all feeling good about ourselves. Thanks for joining us. Good to have everybody on the podcast today. No, here's the thing. When you drive that long race at Spa, I have this little tiny connection to it because I go, I've been on that track. And then I think about the speeds and the reality of that thing, and I go, okay, I've kind of been on the track. I can tell you which way it goes and kind of what it feels like, but then there's this whole other level. So huge congrats to you, and I love that it's the GT as well.
Thanks. Yeah, it's been a long time coming for the 66 car. Now we're in year three of the Ford GT's return to racing and Ford's return to global racing on that scale. And out of all four cars, so for the listeners who haven't been following it, there's two Ford GTs that race in the United States in the IMSA series, and then there's two that race in the World Endurance Championship that travels all over the world, and I drive one of the European cars. And out of all four cars, the 66 car has never won a race. So
get
that monkey off our back, yeah, so it's been heartbreaking for that team because like I'm a third driver, I don't do the entire championship. And I have great co-drivers. They're very fast, good drivers. The team works really hard. We have great team engineers, you name it. But just it's racing. Things happen. And there's just been like a black cloud over the 66 car. So I'm ecstatic for the whole group, my teammates, and obviously for myself. But I'm just really happy that everybody involved in that car finally have had justice to all the hard work that they put into the program over the years.
That's awesome. That's really great.
I want to ask you about race day, but I have to jump ahead because, like Todd said, we've been there on spot driving non-race cars on street tires and knowing how scary Eau Rouge is just in a street car. And then, yeah, we watched the accident. We watched, you know, a lot of the race footage. It was just, you know, I've been there. I've done that. I know what it feels like in an M235i with street tires. In your perception, what's Eau Rouge like? Well, of course, you've got downforce and, you know, it's an there's entirely different league, but I'm just curious, that feeling of Eau Rouge.
That's the add-on question, Billy, is the first question I have to ask you is, do you guys lift in Eau Rouge? Because, of course, in a street car, you have to lift.
Oh, yeah. No kidding.
So you guys weren't braking? You guys just did a lift in the street cars?
No, that's the thing. It's a little bit of braking and then off the gas to roll through the bottom, and then you're back on the gas as you head up the hill.
I don't know if I said this last time I was on the podcast, but the first time I went through Eau Rouge, like I practiced it in iRacing on my simulator, and also I've been on Multimatic's like $1 million crazy simulator. So I felt good about the track, knew where it went, but just the vertical loading of Eau Rouge at that kind of speed is insane. And the first time I was ever on that track, went out of the pits, and pit lane's a little bit closer to Eau Rouge, so you're not going quite as fast, but you're you're close to it. And I knew that in those types of cars, on brand new stickers with high downforce setup, it may or may not be flat, but a half throttle lift should be conservative enough to be at speed and still leave some margin on the table. So coming out of pit lane, I was full throttle, entered the Eau Rouge, went to half throttle, turned in, and as soon as I hit that compression, my head went down, and I'm like looking at the steering wheel, I'm looking at my feet, and I'm like trying to pick my head up because I did not expect that kind of vertical loading, and I'm like struggling against the G's looking up, and it was just it caught me off guard, and just did not expect that kind of G forces. And then you get used to it, but yeah, it's definitely something else just from that. So you kind of have to brace yourself and anticipate that hit in that compression to just keep your eye line up. But as far as taking the corner, yeah, it's in those cars, it's like I said, either flat on new tires, depending on the setup and BOP with the weight of the car and you name it.
Holy
but
cow.
If it's not flat, it's really close to flat with like a very small lift, half throttle or three quarters, staying three quarters throttle, just a minor lift. And yeah, I've taken it flat a lot, and you are really dealing with inches in terms of your turn-in point, and your turn-in point dictates the rest of the corner. If you're going to go off, if you're going to have to gather it at the top of the hill and completely ruin your run down the straightaway to turn five.
Yeah, yeah.
But you have to be so precise with your turn-in. You have to be so precise with how you hit the compression, apexing it at the right side of the road on the top of the hill be able to carry that speed and to be able to do it flat or near flat.
And for those of you listening, that's actually how the 66 car, this team, won. And I was so happy for you because you and a 911 were coming down hot into Eau Rouge on the last lap. And I can't remember if you were driving or not, Billy, but the 66 car was there and passed the 911 going into Eau Rouge. And I thought, wow, I'm so happy for you guys. And you passed a 911.
Which you have such mixed emotions about, yes.
It was very mixed feeling. No, I kid. It was amazing to see that. And, you know, for people who have seen the track, Todd and I have been out there with Ron Simons on a track walk. So every time we've gone, which...
Well, that's the big...
Couple times, three times now.
That's the big speech that Ron gives every time. He's like, folks, you may think you're going to come in here and not brake and not lift and take it flat out, and we will be gathering up your car. So please brake, please lift, please do what we're telling you. And so that's why I wanted to have this discussion, because you and I have gone in and actually multiple cars at this point. We've driven multiple cars around there. I mean, come on, the Alpha 4C versus the M235i are two totally different worlds. But in both cases, it's like, okay, must brake. Okay, now must not be on the gas yet. And it's interesting, Billy, that I'm relating a little bit to you. I stress the little bit here. Because lap to lap to lap, the slight variation of setup for that corner, that corner is a series of dominoes. If you screw up the beginning, it just keeps getting worse. You know, it's just, it's not like, oh, I'll be okay. No. By the time you get to the top of Ready On, it's just all over the place.
Yeah, no kidding.
So it's very interesting to hear your perspective on it, because that, now extra fast and extra flat, I'm a little horrified right now.
And being standing out there on the track, and you know, you think, okay, it looks kind of like a gentle curve and slightly uphill. No, when you're standing on it, you're having trouble balancing. You know what I mean?
You walk it. It's steep,
it's
for
an
sure.
Entirely
yeah, yeah.
different thing. So it's really cool to hear that. Okay, so back to race day, Billy. It's still fresh in your mind. So on race day, when you guys were getting ready, this was the 6 hours, and we're coming up to 24 hours in June here. But for race day, what are you guys thinking about? How do you prep yourself? I know there's questions at the end. You know, people are talking about everything from conditioning to headspace to all those kinds of things. But what are you doing on race day?
On race day, I'm trying not to think much about it. If you get wrapped up in the moment or cause more pressure or anxiety or expectations on yourself, that I guess for any sport, that's a disservice. So I'm just trying to stay relaxed, get everything I need to do accomplished-wise from a PR standpoint, from a preparation standpoint, and enjoying it. There's a bunch of fans there. It's great to see that kind of support, which I think we're starting to see more fans at, like the IMSA races now that IMSA and Grand Am have combined. But over in Europe, there's still just more fans, there's more excitement, so just to be able to see that and appreciate that is really neat to experience when competing over there. So not trying to think too much, and just getting ready to do my job when it's my turn in the car.
Sure, and I would think that's the case, you know, in any kind of competitive situation. You're there, you're getting warmed up, you're ready, you've done all your prep work, so there's nothing emergency to be done. You know, you've theoretically prepped in advance, and that's why you're ready to go.
He didn't just show up this morning and go, what are we doing? What's going on? Yeah.
Hey, guys, what are we doing today?
On the
a lot of people do ask me, even at this, or especially for Le Mans, like, excited. Like, what do you think? You're at Le Mans. It's amazing. You're driving a Ford GT. And I definitely realized the magnitude of all of that. But you try not to think about it, because if you think about it, it's like, oh, wow, this is a big deal. And it just can mess you up. So like, I try to ignore all of that and just try to live in the moment, appreciate the moment, and do the best job I can behind the wheel.
That's really cool. I'm curious about stints, and this may be, I mean, look, this may be a liquid question, but I'm curious about, on a 6-hour race, how are stints decided? How long are your stints supposed to be, and how are they decided?
So 6 hours, for us, we had three drivers per car. A couple other teams did the same. Other teams ran just their two full-time drivers. And so just easy math, each driver would do about 2 hours, and depending on yellows, safety cars, and whatnot, fuel stints are around an hour, a little under an hour. So depending how that all plays out, usually it nicely ends up being roughly 2 hours per driver. So since we can run about an hour, we do two stints and just adjust the final fuel fills based off of how the race played out with yellow flags.
So
if it ran green the entire way, we probably would have to have an additional splash of fuel at some point. That just goes into the strategy of how the race plays out.
Sure. So when you get in, you're expecting to be in for 2 hours. I mean, things could change, but you're expecting a 2-hour stint.
Yes.
Interesting. Okay. And is that the same for Le Mans, or does that get mixed up for Le Mans?
Le Mans, because obviously the race is much longer, 24 hours, it's a lot more fluid. And since we also did Daytona, the 24 hours of Daytona, the 12 hours of Sebring over the years, rarely will you see a driver do a 1-hour stint. But actually, now that I say that, if you watch the race at Spa, some of the teams did pit and did a driver change right at the 1-hour mark. So that was
interesting.
Their strategy. Yeah, I didn't follow their full race and driver change strategy, but for us, we do 2-2-2. And then for Le Mans, rarely will you see a 1-hour driver stint. Normally, it'll be a 2-3 hour, but at Le Mans the past 2 years and Daytona, I had about a 4-hour stint in all three of those races.
Wow.
Holy moly.
4 hours.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how that ended up happening, but in those races, I somehow ended up being in the car for a really long time.
I mean, it's exactly like a 4-hour road trip. It's not. It's exactly the same. You got your cruise control and the air conditioning's blowing, and you listen to your favorite
kind of
music,
feeling.
And maybe I'll turn on an audiobook. I'm here for 4 hours. It's going to be a while. It's going to be fine. It's exactly the same.
It's about to relax.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, 24 hours, as I said, is coming up, and you guys have been doing a lot of testing. You said you were out earlier this week, I think. Obviously, that's on your minds. Are you in the car again with the same guys, same team, everything? Are you adding a fourth driver? Is it just the three of you again? And are you making changes? I mean, do you do different track setups? You know, it's funny because now that you've got the winning car, you know it's dialed, your team is clicking. What changes are you making for the 24-hour race?
So for Le Mans, pretty much across all the classes, there's only three drivers per car. And if you look at like the 24 hours of Daytona, some of the top level pro prototype and GPLM cars run three drivers per car, but some of the pro-am teams run four or even five drivers per car. But at Le Mans, it's almost always three drivers. That's kind of the, I don't know if it's a rule or just the history behind it, but that's what ends up working
just
out to be.
Tradition. We're going with three. Yeah. Everybody does three.
So as far as preparing for Le Mans, we've done testing in the off season. We have a new tire for 2018, working with Michelin, just like they do on the road cars. Michelin fine tunes tires for specific cars and the needs of the car, the weight, the weight distribution, the downforce level, the suspension geometry, the tire loading. There's so much into that in our new 2018 tire. Was an improvement over the 2017, but a lot of fans may not know this, but Le Mans has a specific tire across everybody. Every team has a specific tire for Le Mans, or actually a couple sets, a couple different compounds, because the track is so long, the straightaways are so long, and the tires cool down. Then you have a quick chicane, another long straightaway, hairpin. The way that the tire heats up and cools down and the energy that goes into the tire is different than pretty much any other track on the schedule or
that's fascinating
kind of in the world.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
So like our new 2018 tire worked well at Spa, but that known performance doesn't translate to what our Le Mans 2018 tire is going to do. And then from a balance of performance standpoint, I'm not sure, but the last time I checked, they haven't released the BOP for Le Mans, so nobody knows how much they're going to weigh, how much power they're going to be able to make, and that can change. Like just looking at history from the practice and testing the week beforehand to the race or to qualifying, and then even after qualifying, there's BOP changes before the race. There's so many unknowns, and then also the strategy of what teams do in terms of going slower to try to get concessions at what point. Like there's been drama and controversy over that in the past. And quite frankly, like that's just the nature of the fact that there is a BOP, how there is subjective changes of those rule packages rather than what I like is rewards weight, where if you perform well, you're heavier, so then you go slower. But then there's also strategy in that, like World Challenge teams back in the day, I don't know what their rules are now, but like you'd want to finish second place at every race, so you don't get the weight, and then you win the championship.
Oh, interesting.
So there's a lot of different ways to play all of this, and to be able to say, oh, yeah, we're confident we're going to win, or we definitely think that team's got an edge. There's speculation, but nobody knows.
Of course not. Well, Le Mans is the great question mark every year, I feel like, anyway. I love that there's a Le Mans tire. No, not those ones. Those are for Le Mans. I love that. That's great.
Exactly. Well, we should jump into this car debate here. For Greg, he's out in Manhattan, and this is the Escape from New York edition because he writes to us and says he's been watching for a few years. He's even thought about purchasing some of the vehicles we've talked about, but he wants a car because he lives in Manhattan. He said he's kept this car on and off over the years in the most unreasonable city to keep a car, but he just wants something that he can load up with golf and, you know, surf gear and whatever that is and escape for the weekend with his friends, with his buddies, get out of town. But it still has to be kept and parked and, you know, stored in New York City.
But that's the thing. If you live in Manhattan and you are a car guy, you are a dedicated car guy because it is not set up for you to have and enjoy a car. The cost of just storing your car is so exorbitant that this is what Jerry Seinfeld owns, like a garage somewhere in Manhattan, because of course he's Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah,
he has that kind
nice
of money.
You've got that
but,
kind of
but
money.
The, but the point is, if you want a car and you want to live in Manhattan, you are dedicated to having a car, and that is Greg, which is cool. He says most of his trips are at least an hour. He may do 5 hours with 3-4 buddies, and they're off doing something, and it's always fun. So it has to really haul stuff in both the speed and gear perspective. It has to haul, which is good. He's about a 6-foot-tall guy, kind of a big guy, so he's thinking, okay, me and all of my similarly sized friends.
Right.
So there will be no Miatas in this discussion. Just put it out there. There will not be a Lotus Elise. We won't shop.
Is this even a discussion for you guys? Like,
I know.
Bread and butter.
What are we going to do? We can't talk Porsche or Lotus. What are we going to do?
No Caymans involved? I don't understand what's going on here. So, yeah, Greg, thank you for writing in. This is going to be pretty different for us, and I'm glad that we've got Billy here to offer some suggestions, too, because Billy's in Europe frequently, I would say, and, you know, he says, if I were in Europe, the answer would be easy. RS4, RSX Avant. He's been looking at X5 M's, Cayennes, BMW wagons. He's looked at a 2011 Audi A6 Avant, and then the big GL450 Mercedes SUV. He's also talked about the F-Pace, Jaguar F-Pace 3.5, and the Alfa Romeo Stelvio Sport. Pretty interesting. The Stelvio just doesn't strike me as a big enough car for what he's describing. It's interesting, Greg, because you describe golf bags and surf gear and ski gear and all this stuff with five big people, and then, you know, you're suggesting maybe a car that I don't see that happening unless you've got a roof rack or a trailer behind you.
Yeah, I don't think the Stelvio's hatch is big enough for a lot of this discussion.
I mean,
we're talking about
bigger cars. It's not often that you and I go there, you know. It's talking bigger cars, but still some performance. Got to be comfortable. I think, Greg, you're open to either sedans or SUVs, it sounds like. You're kind of open to things. And then it says, my perfect fit is a Tesla P100D, S or X, but those are out of my price range. And Greg, you didn't give us a specific budget, which means we're going to
probably
blow that up.
Well, but he's suggesting based on that reality of those Teslas that we're under six figures here.
That, I would think
we're,
so.
And we're assuming, yeah. But we're probably under six figures here, because everything he's talking about that he's looked at, you could theoretically get one certainly used for under six figures. Now, I will say to Greg real quickly, if you really want the Tesla, you can get a used one of those.
Could.
You know, yeah, I mean, you could go use. Shop used Teslas, and you could actually get under six figures. You can get ones that are running 60 to 70 grand, and that is a possibility. So, I mean, I don't think they're completely out, but obviously you're not going to get a new one is what it sounds like. So I'm very curious where we're all going on this. We need to haul stuff. I have kind of my very favorite on this, but I wanted to speak to some other ones. Where are you guys?
All right, Billy, I'm turning things over to you. We know kind of the budget range. You've looked at the cars that he's looking at here. You've seen the cars that he's thinking about. I mean, I love the RS6 Avant or the RS4 Avant. But an A4 just doesn't strike me. That size doesn't strike me as good for what we're talking about here. So it's got to be big enough for all the stuff and people, mm-hmm. but still small enough for Manhattan. I don't know that we're going to accomplish
small
either.
Enough for it to have fun because, yeah, small enough for Manhattan is I don't have a car. That's small enough for Manhattan.
I suppose so.
So we're above that either way. That's anyway, yeah.
Okay, so Billy, where did you go?
Yeah, so since you're already down that road, I definitely think an A4, that class of car is just too small, so you're looking at like a 5 Series BMW, a E Series Mercedes, the E63 wagons. My buddy Liam has one of those, and that thing is a blast. It mm-hmm. is just a rocket ship. So to get your performance bug fixed, that is definitely up that alley. Plus, with it being a wagon, you can throw a bunch of stuff and fill it to the roof in the back. So that kind of popped out in my head, or the BMW M5 wagon. I don't know when the first year of that was and if you could get a used one of those within the budget. But as far as wagons go, the A6 or the RS6 or E63 or M5 would be kind of my three go-tos for wagons.
I mean, it seems like the wagon thing is, you know, you kind of think that it would
feels
be a
like
natural
the
fit.
Salt.
They're just not as popular here. You know, you see them everywhere in Europe.
Yeah.
RS6, I would love it if it were here.
I wish it was here,
don't
yeah.
think people would buy it.
Yeah, well, not enough people would buy it. But I'm amazed, honestly, that the E63 survives. Great one, by the way, Billy. I'm amazed it survives. I mean, there's you and I have been biking before here in Park City, and it's SUV,
yeah.
SUV, Subaru, whatever weird, ridiculous thing you and I brought. And then an E63 wagon shows up sometimes, and it's kind of smoked out, and he's got, I forget what it is, but he's got a funny license plate that kind of winks at the fact that you don't know what my car is, but I can kill you, is kind of what the license plate winks
right.
at.
Yeah.
And I love it. It's got, you know, he's got a bike rack on the back. It's killer. So that E63 wagon, I'm surprised, Greg, that you didn't mention that, because you mentioned the big Mercedes SUV, but the E63, what could you get with one of those used? That is really a great one.
Don't hold their value that well.
That's true.
So you could get a couple-year-old one very reasonably, where the first owner takes the huge hit, mm-hmm. and you pretty much have a brand-new car that is just – they sound awesome. They're really comfortable inside, so as far as big people – fitting in there, I think that's right up that alley, and then they have a pretty reasonable space in the back, and sure, it doesn't scream sports car, but the sleeper aspect is
for sure.
Is always pretty cool.
For sure, agree with that.
I like that. Okay, so I was a little bit mixed on things. I divided it into sedans and SUVs.
Okay, cool.
I have only one SUV, but I think it could work. For sedans, I was thinking Audi S8. I initially thought RS7
okay.
Audi, but then I thought, okay, let's go a little bit bigger, the Audi S8, mm-hmm. buy the most you can for your budget, Greg, or, of course, the newest, fastest Panamera for your budget. Those are big cars,
yes.
but the back center, you know, seating area, I don't know that you're going to get five people in there. They're really built for four.
I mean, the S8,
which is
yes,
fine.
More so than the Panamera. But
that's
yeah.
kind of why I thought yeah. Audi S8, and then I even thought, okay, something totally different for you, Greg, Charger Hellcat? Those are big cars. The
they
Charger
are.
To begin
they
with.
Are.
If anybody had a reason to buy a Hellcat, it's probably you, because we're talking about loading the car up with people, and
yeah.
you want power when it's under, you know, five people in the car and a bunch of gear.
Yeah, I see where
okay,
you're going.
Okay, now we've got the proper engine to be able to
yeah.
cruise like you want to. I had the Kia Stinger GT out there, but based on our discussion, I don't know that that's going to be a fit here.
Maybe not. It's worth, Greg, it's worth you driving. Honestly, even if it hasn't been on your radar to this point, brand new one running your 50K, at least go drive the Stinger. It's a pretty good sized car. It's not S8 size. It's not, you know, a Hellcat Charger, but it's more toward that end than it is a 3 Series, if you want to think about it in comparison. It's worth driving. That's a good one.
Okay, so for my SUV choice, I just have one, Greg, and that is a 2018 Dodge Durango SRT. This is the SRT motor, 475 horsepower. They start at about $64,000. So yes, they're definitely on the high side, but I like the size of this car. I like that they are kind of a sleeper. Mm-hmm. You think, okay, it's just the family truckster, but no, you've got a lot of power, and they're nice inside, and the 2018s are great. The interior is nice. It feels more luxurious than you would initially think. Durangos have come a long way since their first iteration way back whenever they came out. They're a bigger car now. There's a lot of space, a lot of comfortability in this car, and I think you could get all your gear. I'm thinking, what does Chevy and what does Ford make in the category of a Durango SRT? Not a lot, to
Ford
be honest.
Edge Sport.
Edge Sport,
yes. But we're smaller now. But bravo on speaking up on behalf of Ford, though. Well done on that regard.
Agreed.
But yes.
Yeah, so again, I try not to be too biased in general car discussions because I just love cars. But since you threw it out there, the Edge Sport, I'm 6 foot, and there's plenty of room to sit in the front seats and have legroom in the back, and there's a decent amount of room in the trunk. I'm not sure how it compares square footage wise to the Durango, but it's kind of in that same size vehicle that I did look at the F-Pace, and the trunk of that seemed to be a little bit smaller than the Edge Sport. And my wife has an Edge Sport, and that thing is a riot with the 2.7 liter twin turbo V6. It's over 300 horsepower. It moves really good. It handles like a sedan. So yeah, the Durango is a great option. Looking for that, I think the Edge Sport could definitely be considered in that new, more affordable price range for a sporty SUV.
But you've got a good point here because, you know, as I said earlier about the exterior dimensions, the Durango's not small. I like it for the interior space and I like it for the engine. But on the other hand, imagine parking that thing anywhere in a car park in Manhattan.
Sure, sure.
Maybe you've got a point here, Billy. The Edge Sport or the F-Pace could do better just from exterior dimensions. And if they're still nice on the inside, you know, as far as space, dimensions, people, gear, all that stuff, then it could be a consideration. Because that's the balance, is the exterior dimensions versus what you're getting. And I think, yeah, Durango could be nice. It's plenty of space. It's like a couch in the third row all the way back there. But they're big cars,
they
too,
big,
so that's the problem. I'm trying to weigh that. So, okay, I like your suggestions. I like you throwing that in there, too.
From a price standpoint, with a new car, the Durango and the Ford Edge Sport being new, those are good options. But going into the few-year-old mark, and also I think what he said he wanted were his options of, like, an X5M, those things are a blast. I really like those.
They are. They're
also, a Porsche Cayenne, whether a base Cayenne or a GTS, those things are a riot and also are very sporty, comfortable inside, can fit four people comfortably and a decent amount of room. So I would definitely throw those into the mix and agree with them that those are good options in the used market.
Yeah, I wanted to speak to those two specifically. I think the X5M and the Cayenne GTS, I think you would enjoy either of those. You're going to need to go drive one, Greg, in both cases, and here's why I say that. And you're going to need to drive one with the weird headspace of, I mean, you can think about what you're going to be packing in these. Because the problem with both of those, and I say that as an owner, the problem with both of those is that the back hatch now has got a tilt to it. They've restricted, if you will, or invaded a little bit of your storage space because the back hatch has got a nice rake to it.
Well,
now,
for the sake of styling and for the sake of look
absolutely.
Of the car, yeah.
The Cayenne that my wife and I have, the first gen, has got a good amount of space in the rear hatch. The newer one has got the same amount of floor space, but the roof restricts further.
Right.
So
how
are you packing it? Now, it may be fine, but the other thing about the X5M and the GTS, again, both of them, even, I mean, in normal world or on a track, you're like, how is this capable? But you also might be in a situation where four guys are probably going to be very happy. Five may be a bit cramped, But I want to come back to our pilgrimage experience, which was a current gen, or actually, I guess, second gen, because they're just coming out with a third. Second gen Cayenne GTS.
Yeah.
Four of us. Many, many, many Pelican cases. We probably had over 100 pounds of camera gear, plus all of our personal bags.
Yeah, backpacks and
going
all that
170
kind of stuff.
Plus on the Autobahn, like it's nothing. Okay, so that is an amazing car to do everything you're talking about if it's big enough for you storage wise. The unknown here is, look, you can put skis on the roof. The unknown here what are you really hauling and how much space do you really need? Because skis and things are easy to get outside the car. You have to drive those. There's one we haven't brought up.
Okay,
Billy got close, so I'm going to give the bookend on the other end because I love that E63 for you, Greg. We need to talk about the Cadillac CTS-V wagon.
You're right. I just don't know if the interior space will cut it on that car.
I think it's comparable to everything else we're talking about,
though. You open
the
boot on that thing, and it's, hey, it's a wagon. Why is there not enough space in this wagon?
It's not a tall back. But it's got a good amount of distance on it. So I think you need to take a serious look. And these things selling right now, you know, that big supercharged engine, the 6-speed, it's before the Cadillac Q system, so you avoid that problem as well. They're selling for about $60,000. It's got to be inside your budget.
That's true.
Nobody's going to know what that car is. You can get people and gear in it. So, I mean, you and I climbed all in and out of that one that we drove for a fast blast, and I kept being surprised by how usable and fun it was at the same time.
We did like that.
CTS-V wagon. If it was me deciding for you, Greg, right now, I'd say you drive the E63 and the CTS-V and you pick one. But I have to bring it up for sure.
And if you have leftover money, I'll say, if it's...
On this podcast, leftover money? What is this weird thing we're talking about?
Well, I was thinking about John Hennessy, the tuner in Texas. You know, whatever budget you have left over, if you can find a deal on a CTS-V wagon, you could take it to him and say whatever you want to do to it and then boost the power on that thing if you want. I mean, that would be a unique car, especially in Manhattan.
The leftover money in this scenario is going to go to getting a parking space that's bigger than compact.
Well, that's true.
That's where it's going to go
to
in Manhattan.
We might have
to
cut his budget in half, and so it's you know, Honda Accord for you, my friend, and then congratulations, you can afford to park in Manhattan.
So we have that question, Greg, where we hope we've been helpful, but we're glad for you writing in, and Billy, great suggestions as well. So we're going to take a quick break and we will be right back.
If you like sports, you should check out Real GM Radio. Danny LaRue, the basketball expert, sports writer, and podcaster, has a show here on Podcast One Sportsnet. He breaks down all things NBA with some of NBA's best thought leaders.
For in-depth conversation breaking down the NBA playoffs, check out Real GM Radio every Thursday on Podcast One Sportsnet and Apple Podcasts. Also remember to rate that show and this one.
I'm not going very far.
It's too uncomfortable.
I'm in a hurry. Sometimes I just forget.
There's no such thing as a good excuse for not buckling up. You're not only putting yourself at risk of injury or death, it could also cost you lots of money. Cops are writing tickets, so why take the risk? Do the smart thing and start buckling up every trip, day or night. Click it or ticket. Paid for by NHTSA.
You know what's a must-have in your car care arsenal? It's a Brush Hero. This is the water-powered detailing tool that's perfect for tough areas like wheel spokes and engines, tailpipes and grills, and even bicycles. Interestingly, Brush Hero requires no batteries or electricity. It scrubs slowly with an impressive amount of torque.
This was created by car guys. It's designed to be tough, quick, and effective without causing damage. It's easy to use. Just hook it up to a standard garden hose, flip the handy on-off switch, and start cleaning. Brush Hero is a great gift idea, and they've got an extensive line of gift sets and accessories.
And now, our listeners can enjoy 10% off their order at brushhero.com with code DRIVER. You can also find the Brush Hero at select Costco and Walmart stores. But don't forget to use the code DRIVER at brushhero.com for 10% off, and all orders over $40 ship free.
Everybody's got a to-do list. You drop off the dry cleaning, you pick up some milk. I've got an idea. Let's save hundreds of dollars in car insurance.
And the good thing is, you don't have to drop off or pick up anything. All you have to do is go to geico.com, and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance.
Having extra money in your pocket might be the most rewarding thing on your to-do list today.
Geico presents eyewitness interviews with inanimate objects.
This is Brian Bruno, live on the scene of a recent windstorm, here to describe the event, a chest of drawers.
There's a storm howling outside, so I thought I'd stay in and watch a rom-com. 5 minutes into the flick, a tree branch slams through the window.
Were you hurt?
I just got a scratch on my chest.
Your chest of drawers can't help you in a windstorm, but the GEICO Insurance Agency can help you get covered for personal property damage. Call GEICO to see how affordable homeowners insurance can be.
We're back with Billy Johnson and having interesting time discussing racing and giant SUVs and all kinds of stuff. But there were some great questions on social media, especially one from Waffy.Y on Instagram here, who's asking about the different classes of endurance and track racing. And I thought this would be good, Billy, for you to jump in with, because yes, you're in the World Endurance Championship, but there's other sanctioning bodies, there's other racing. And I'm just curious, you mentioned early on that you don't do the full season with these guys. So what other kinds of racing do you do, and in what other classes? But first of all, if you could just sort of back up and break it down and also relate it to the interests of, you know, there's the top end, there's the, you know, LMP cars for Le Mans and the Formula One cars. But, you know, it's almost like the better wheel-to-wheel racing is in the class you're in, the GTE and, you know, that kind of thing. So would you break that down and kind of explain where you're at?
No pressure, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So for the World Endurance Championship, there's four classes. There's two prototypes and two GT cars. And in each class, there's a pro-pro, which is called pro, and a pro-am category. So in the prototypes, there's LMP1, which used to be the Porsche and the Audi, and now Toyota is the front runner.
Right.
For that. And then there's actually a couple of privateer teams running LMP1s that it's a different rule set. They're not hybrids. There's a lot to that. And there's some controversy of that because, I don't know, they're really trying to have Toyota win and win the 24 Hours of Le Mans, since they've never done that. I don't know. I don't really care too much for that class. And it might be going away for something much cooler, which we could say here in a minute. Then the Pro-Am prototype is LMP2. So you have professionals and you have amateur businessmen, you name it, that help with funding. And there's a lot of those cars, there's a lot of LMP2s. They look just like the P1s. So for your average viewer, it's a little hard to distinguish those two, but they have less power and they're slower than the LMP1s.
Okay. Should we just show the amount of money that they're spending, you know, along with their track speed and their braking and G-forces?
There's a ticker on the side, yeah.
Here's how much money they've put into this car versus, you see that faster car? They put more money in. That's why they're faster.
This driver did this donation. That's why he's in the seat. Yeah, exactly. That's terrible.
So then looking at the GT class, again, two classes. There's the pro class, and then there's the AM class, or the pro-AM class. And the pro class is all factory efforts with factory drivers. And then the AM class has professional drivers, as well as, same thing, businessmen who help bring funding to the program. But the GT cars, they are 911, they are an M6, they are a Ferrari 488, they are a Ford GT, they are a Corvette. So they're easier to relate to, and it's even cooler for this year, 2018, in the WEC series, because BMW has come back. So there's two cars there. Porsche for Le Mans is now bringing four cars.
Wow.
Aston Martin has their brand new, I think, 4-liter twin-turbo V8 from Mercedes, with their new Vantage race car.
Oh, cool.
Ferrari has the 488, but they have their Evo version, which is kind of like a Gen 2 modified with more aero and stuff to make the car go faster. So technically that's considered a new car. Porsche has their mid-engine 911.
Yeah, baby.
When does it stop being a 911? I'm just gonna. This is a rhetorical question. It's just a rhetorical question.
Hey.
But when does it stop becoming a 911?
Hey,
anyway,
they've got mid-engine history, so they can do whatever they want.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Anyway.
Well, since you love Porsches, and a lot of people like to pick on Fords for making a supercar built for that class, I'll throw it back onto Porsche and say Ford built a car to the rule book. Exactly, called a no-waiver car. They don't ask to move the engine or change suspension pickup points or...
Sure.
Great point.
Porsche turning that 911 into a mid-engine car, that's pretty extreme. they should build, and I'm calling them out, they should build a mid-engine 911 just like that. I think that would be awesome for a production standpoint. It would be awesome for a Porsche M standpoint, and I'm sure a lot of people would jump on that, and they need to get over their 911s need to be rear-engine, but we're going to race a 911 that's a mid-engine. No, make a street car version.
You know what? I fully agree with you because that would just add to the 25 variants that you can already buy of the Porsche 911. We could add however many because we've got the mid-engine Targa, the mid-engine GTS, the mid-engine 4S, on and on and on.
So then we'd have the mid-engine T. It'd be the 911.
You know we would.
It'd be the 911 MT.
Right.
Anyway, yeah.
What a great idea.
Call it an RSR.
Something.
You could just call the whatever GT3 RSR. Streetcar.
I agree. That would be awesome. That'd be brilliant. That would be very, very
but
cool.
Billy, you are right because I relate. I mean, there's these spaceships going around everybody at much higher speeds, the LMP cars. It's
the
amazing
boys,
to see and amazing to watch. And, you know, you see that in-car footage and you're going, oh my gosh. But I relate to the cars that you're driving, the Ferraris, the Porsches, the BMWs, just because they are somewhat close to streetable, even though I know they're race cars. But I relate to that, and I like the battles going on personally. As much as we love Le Mans, those LMP cars are just, they're spaceships. They're rocketing around the track. But I think where the fun action is from a viewership standpoint is the class you're in.
Well, definitely. It's not just relatable, but and everybody was going to complain about BOP not being fair and this, that, the other thing. But at the end of the day, there is such good racing in the GTE class. And now that we have new manufacturers, we have more cars, great drivers, more really good drivers. Just the competition is so high. It is definitely the show. It is definitely the thing to keep your eye on and follow. And on that note, I've read some things online that it looks like, I don't know if it's 2020 or when they want to implement it, but I think this is for the better for the FIA and ACO to ditch the LMP1 cars and make the fast cars. I think they're calling it it may be like LMP1 silhouette, where they look like real cars.
Interesting.
And I think that's more relatable and cooler. And hopefully it relates more back to the GT1 cars, which I think was the coolest cars ever made. The McLaren F1 GTR, the Porsche GT1, and the Mercedes CLK GT1. Those things are just amazing, and hopefully we can get back to that.
That'd be really cool.
And there is an entertainment value that the race organizers need to consider. And it sounds like they're doing that more because instead of just racing for the sake of racing, there's the fan standpoint and the relatability that we're talking about. They have to incorporate that, and it sounds like they're thinking about that more and more these days.
I'll throw one at you then. We have our friend Mike at Cam Automag. He says, all right, put you and your teammates, you, Olivier, and Stefan, in identically prepped Fiestas. Give you each 10 laps at Silverstone.
This is good.
This is one of those political landmine questions. Welcome to a room full of rakes. Who sets the quickest lap time? Who wins the race overall? And who's complaining that they got the slow car?
And unless they're listening, you can...
is going to complain they got the slow car.
Of course they are. Yeah. No pressure. That's a room full of rakes. I know it is.
Biased. Yeah. I think if you ask any all three of us, you're going to get everybody saying they're going to be the fastest. They're going to win the race, but I do a lot of the road car development for Ford, so I have tracked slower street cars down to Fiestas, Focuses, on up to the Ford GT. So running street cars around the track, I'm pretty good at that. So I'm going to be a little bit biased and arrogant and say that I can probably beat them on that.
Like it. Well done.
Well, yeah, you've got a foundation in the answer. I like that. There's a question over here from Scott D. He's asked a bunch of questions. Scott, thank you for writing in. On Instagram, he's saying, of all the cars you have ever driven in a race, which are probably many, if you could keep just one, which one would it be?
That's tough. But again, I hate to throw the Ford flag out there and don't want to be viewed as a overly biased person, but just my personal involvement with the Ford GT, driving the car, being one of the first drivers to drive both the production car and the the race car, and then to be able to race it, it means just a lot to me personally. And then just what the program has been able to accomplish, and yeah. I'd have to hands down pick the Ford GT.
I'm gonna give you that one. I think your background with the car and what the car is, why not, man? That's a broad.
Well, yeah, and you weren't just brought to the program here, plop you in a race car and start driving. You've got a long history with it. I mean, you've got the development history with it.
Ignoring that and making the conversation a little bit more interesting to non-Ford fans, the real E46 M3 GTR was pretty awesome.
Ooh, I would imagine.
That sounds delightful.
That sounds great.
Well, we've got to skewer our own interests. I mean, you know, Todd loves Lotus, I love Porsche, but we have to skewer our own selves because
for sure
we get, you know, we can't take ourselves too seriously, right? I mean, there's flaws with every car. There's,
you and I rarely have a problem of taking ourselves too seriously. Our issue. Yeah.
So yes, there's no problem waving the banner for Ford because we love Fords too. We love everything about the race cars and what they're doing, and I'm curious to see where they go. We've actually talked about Ford pulling, Billy, as you probably know, Ford pulling their cars from U.S. over time. They're just not going to sell cars here anymore. They're going after the SUVs, the Edge Sports, like you were talking about.
Yeah.
Great, bold move. What's next for Ford? I think everybody's waiting, as we are too. But we love the race cars. We love Fiesta STs, and they're maybe not quite $7,500 yet.
But they're borderline disposable.
But they're
getting
so
there. Much fun. Yeah, exactly. What other questions do you have, Paul?
I had a question for you, Billy, and it has to do with Formula E and the fact that so many manufacturers are going away at the top level. The LMP cars, the Porsche, the Audis that you talked about are joining Formula E or electric racing programs. What other series do you and your teammates drive in? Have you considered Formula E? Have you been approached by any of these teams? It just seems like, you know, as much as we talk about electric cars, they are somewhat relatable to people now, but for the most part, they're not. They don't enter our daily lives, really. Somewhat, I'll say, and we are driving a couple of them for our season 3 on Velocity, but...
But it's like 2% of the market share, though. That's
very
the
much
thing,
so.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, how in Formula One, the technology does trickle down to road car technology. You know, the tires on Formula E cars are designed to be the lower profile so that it does relate to later road car technology. So therefore...
Well, they are like road car tires. They're treaded and...
Yeah, exactly. So it's that kind of thinking. Yeah. But, you know, back to the Formula E programs or just electric car racing series in general, does that interest you? Do you see a lot of teams going that direction? Are you bummed that Audi and Porsche pulled out just from a competition standpoint? And now Toyota's... You know, I'm sure they're looking around going, great, but on the other hand...
This year's ours.
Where did everybody go?
Yeah.
You know, I'm just curious your thoughts on that, just from, like I said, electric and that series growing.
Well, to answer one of your questions, my teammate Harry is one of the test drivers on one of the Formula E teams. So he's involved in that. Me personally, I'm not sure. I think there's just... not enough information out there or open information on the real impact of electric cars, just with all the emissions and environmental impact it takes to get that lithium out of the ground, the fact that we can't recycle it yet or recycle it as efficiently. I'm not sure, and I'm without more information on the true impact that those have, I can't comment on that or really believe 100% in that. But hybrids, I think, makes a lot of sense because they just improve the overall efficiency of a gallon of gas.
Sure.
I think that makes a lot of sense, and there's been some big heads of other companies who explain their skepticism of electric energy, and I think there's some validity to that, but that could also be some political stuff on their end. So right now, I don't really have I don't think anybody has enough information to truly balance out to say electric cars are definitely better for the environment without looking at the whole picture. But sure, if you want to say, yeah, they don't burn gas, so they're more efficient, I think that's way too narrowly focused to be able to say that's the case. And with government subsidies to make them less expensive and make electricity for them less expensive, that could be a little bit biased, and I'm not going to I'm going to hold a reservation on that, and until, which might not ever happen, that those kind of studies are done. But I do like the direction of hybrid. It's coming across all brands, all levels. So the development that was done in LMP1 with Porsche and Audi and that Toyota.
Yeah, for sure.
That kind of trickle down does make sense. And as far as other series goes, I'm not sure. I think wherever there's a good opportunity, if I had an opportunity to drive a Formula E car, I would definitely jump in that if it was a good program. So
sure.
As a racer, it doesn't matter. If it's a shopping cart, if there's a shopping cart world finals, I want to be in that.
This is how we know he's a race driver. That's exactly right. But, you know, we've joked about it before, Paul. The reason that Audi and Porsche are now in Formula E is because what's diesel? I've never done.
Right.
We've never heard of diesel. We have to distance ourselves as far as we possibly can from anything with diesel on it. So let's go. You know what we should do? We should do electric racing. That's what we should do.
Nobody's ever thought of that.
Anyway, so there's a couple other questions that popped up here for us. I had a couple I wanted to touch on really quickly. Jared asked for $30,000, new GTI or used Mercedes GLA AMG 45.
Oh, I saw this question. Excellent.
I think it's the Mercedes.
I'm with you.
And I say that because of the personality of that car and because it's not common. It's the oddball choice, and it is. And I can't believe how fast those things depreciate, and they're fun.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on the GLA.
They do sound good. You're right. You're right. And then Kareem wrote into me and said, would I ever consider a C7 Corvette as my next car after the Lotus? Interesting you bring that up, because every now and then I see one and I'm just like, wonder. They're very tempting.
For you, I see an Evora or a BMW 1M in your future. Both of those cars are
genuinely higher on the short list. Yeah, but I have to say the C7, every time I see one or drive one, is a genuinely tempting car. What else do we have, guys?
Well, I've got a question here.
A lot of fun, too.
Oh, completely, yeah.
All right, Billy. Ed H. on Facebook is asking about the flashing lights of a passing LMP1 car. So a little bit back to the LMP, the big boys, the spaceships rocketing by. Are they a problem when they're roaring up behind you?
They definitely have extremely bright lights. So in the middle of the night, when you have daylight shining in your mirrors, it's you can't tell where they are or how fast they're approaching. We have that Delphi radar system that has a little chevron triangle thing that shows you how fast cars are approaching and where they're going, and that helps a ton, because without that, you'd be completely guessing. And even then, you're still guessing because you don't know what that closing speed is. But I'd say the more difficult thing would probably be the LMP2 cars, because they actually have higher top speeds because they're not doing the regen of the hybrid system before the brake zone. Like the LMP1s, they get up to speed really fast and then they kind of stall out. They're regenning their hybrid system and then they brake. So
interesting.
They don't have as high of a top speed as the P2s.
Hmm.
So because the P2s have a higher top speed, but their closing rate in the medium and low speed corners isn't as good, they're actually a little bit harder to judge in terms of where they are and if they're going on the inside of you into a corner. And those guys love to dive bomb people because they don't have quite as much power as the P1s to just immediately drive by you exiting the corner, which I think the acceleration rate of LMP1s is just insane. If you've never seen one in person, they are just crazy. So I'd say the P2s are a little bit more concerning in the middle of the night.
Interesting. Wow.
Crazy. Billy, thank you so much for joining us. We wish you all the success for June coming up. Do you have some testing to be done? Are you traveling a little bit more before the race? It's, I think, 16, 17, that weekend in June. Is that right?
It's coming up quick. I just got back from some road car development with Ford, and then don't really have anything until the Le Mans test that's on the 2nd.
Okay.
So coming up here in about a week and a half, we'll be doing the official Le Mans test, and then the week later is the race.
Awesome. Amazing.
Well, at least you get a little downtime before, you know, ramping back up. But, man, we're excited to be watching, and I'm sure everybody will also be. And cheering you on, man. Thank you so much, like we said, and for joining us again. And love having you back on. It's just fun to hear that whole side of the, you know, race. And we see it on TV or we see it wherever, but it's very different to hear the personal stories from you.
Yeah, and also because of the fact that you and I, we get on track now and then throughout the calendar year. Billy's like, uh-huh. Yeah, you're driving a track.
We've
good
done
job,
the 24
guys.
Hours of Lemons in a Subaru Outback.
Yes,
it's nearly the same.
It's exactly right? the same, yes.
Wearing helmets.
Where's my invite?
Well, that's funny that you say that, because there is the part of me that just goes, just 1 year, I want to show up at Lemons where it's you and me and Dale and Billy Johnson. It's like, you know what? We're going to sit here and we're going to let Billy drive. But yeah, that would be a blast.
We've got a ringer. The Subaru Outback team.
I'd be down.
Man.
Call me up.
I love it. How on earth is that Outback that fast? Well, let me tell you. Anyway, I love it. Thanks so much for being on, Billy. We love having you with us. Thank you guys for listening as always. EverydayDriverTV@gmail.com is our direct email address if you want to send in your own car debate. Oh, I should remind you.
Oh,
this is podcast 299.
Yes, it is.
You know what that means?
Yikes.
Sheer Madness is up next. Podcast 300 will be an all questions podcast. Watch our social media because we will post for questions. We're asking for no car questions. It will be an hour of, honestly, I don't know.
We'll have to see. That's coming up next podcast. So watch for the announcement on that. And guys, thank you again. Looking forward to next time. Cheers, everyone.
Let's consider the secret life of the innermost nesting doll. Living most of her life in the dark, inside the other nesting dolls, she has plenty of time to think, if she could. Sadly, she has no brain. However, when an innermost nesting doll hears that Geico not only saves people money, but also has been providing great service for over 75 years, she thinks it's obvious you should switch. Because yes, switching to Geico is a no-brainer. Pity the innermost nesting doll and her lot in life.
ADT can design and install a smart home just for you, backed by 24/7 protection. A new smart home at your service, customized for your lifestyle. Set up custom automations unique to your home to automatically do the things like lock the doors or set the thermostat when you leave. Even close your garage door from virtually anywhere. ADT will set up your home with multiple smart home devices and security features like indoor and outdoor cameras, locks, lights, and garage door control, even video doorbells. Visit ADT.com/podcasts to learn more about how ADT can design and install a secure smart home just for you.